Ladies and gentlemen, we do not have a quorum yet this morning, but we do have a lot of work, or this afternoon, I should say. We do have a lot of work to do, so I would like to get started. We're going to start with Representative Lehmannsville, House File 976. Well, welcome to committee, Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. Happy to be here today to present House File 976 for consideration to be laid over for the transportation bill.
Thank you, Representative Lehman. I believe this is your first time in front of our committee.
And you know what? I've got candy in my office.
Darn. We're not meeting in your office. Maybe we'll have a meeting after the meeting.
Maybe we'll have a meeting after. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I am really pleased to be here today, and I have with me a city administrator from the city of Grand Rapids, who I'll introduce here in a second. But what we're here today to talk about is the Iron Range Regional Rail Initiative. And what this is a collaborative effort toward increasing freight rail routes in northeast Minnesota to maintain the health and vitality of the state's economy. This has been an issue for decades, really, in our community, but more recently a collaborative has formed and made this a priority economic development issue for the region. It's led by a private-public partnership that includes Itasca County, the City of Grand Rapids, the City of Cohasset, the Itasca Economic Development Corporation, and the Itasca Regional Rail Authority, as well as companies like UPM Blandin and Minnesota Power. Collectively, the coalition represents a group of interests that deeply understand the region's economic development potential and its importance to Minnesota. And to talk about the detail and exactly what we're asking for today, I'd like to introduce to testify Tom Pagel, who's the city administrator of the City of Grand Rapids and one of the collaborative partners.
Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Chair Torkelson, my name is Tom Pagel. I'm the city administrator for the City of Grand Rapids. I'd like to thank you and start out by talking about what the current rail situation is up on the Iron Range. Currently, on the Iron Range, within your packet, there's a map that identifies the rail corridors throughout northeastern Minnesota. And predominantly, we're served by two Class 1 railroads. Unfortunately, it's separated into the west half being served by the Burlington Northern Santa Fe and the east half of the Iron Range being served by the CN. And what this does is it creates a captive rail shipping environment where there is no competitive shipping rates for our current industries, and it makes it very difficult when attracting new industries to the Iron Range to improve the economic vitality of northeast Minnesota and the economic vitality of the entire state of Minnesota. Recognizing this, this committee that Representative Lehman has mentioned has been working for about 18 months in the very preliminary stages of developing about an 11-mile plus or minus corridor to create additional rail that would open up competition, lower rates, and create a better economic environment to our industries in northeast Minnesota. We've held about nine public stakeholder engagement meetings throughout the Iron Range, have received very positive feedback. We've been working through the engineering and routing assessment, looking at route alternatives for about the 11-mile corridor, primarily focused on the Western Range at this time because of our limited funding that we've had. We are finalizing funding to complete the engineering and routing assessment. It's about $375,000. That portion is being funded in part by $275,000 from the IRRRB, a $50,000 grant from the Blandon Foundation, and then the coalition as a group has put together $50,000 to finish that. What we would be looking at with the current funding request is moving this project forward through the STB application process and get a start on the EIS process. That would help us further the project along, put together very good estimates of costs. Right now we're estimating a rail project to be somewhere between $35 and $55 million, but by moving this forward we can further refine the route alignment, preferred route alignment and design, and put together good numbers and develop construction funding options to move the project forward. So with that, that's really the project at a higher level. Would be available for questions.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Pagel. I actually don't see any member questions. Representative Rundeck does have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cagle, do you have you identified a number of businesses then along this proposed route that are going to be able to utilize it?
Mr. Pagel.
Currently within the coalition we have, I'm going to count on my hand here, we have four existing businesses that would be utilizing this corridor. In addition, we have a new industrial park in the city of Cohasset that would be adjacent to the preferred rail corridor that would open up access for other new businesses to have direct access to it.
Great. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Any closing remarks, Representative Lane?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm going to go up to my office and get my bags of candy and come back down. But I really do appreciate this time. I just want to impress on the group that there are several large businesses, businesses involved in paper making, businesses involved in mining that will benefit from this, and as well as future expansion opportunities. And that's why the cities have come together, the counties come together, the economic development agencies have come together and made this an economic development priority. So I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you. The motion is to lay over House File 976 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Yes. Thank you.
Next, we have Representative Barr's Bill 1984.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Would you care to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1984 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. I'm very excited to present this bill to you. It's a bill to appropriate $3.5 million to renovate and construct a maintenance and facility. Also to purchase communication equipment for the Minnesota Wing Training and Mission Aircraft Maintenance Facility located at Fleming Field in South St. Paul. The Minnesota Wing Civil Air Patrol is an all-volunteer, not-for-profit benevolent civic association established by an act of Congress to provide services to the state of Minnesota. The Civil Air Patrol's mission includes aerospace education, STEM, search and rescue, disaster relief, homeland security, and a youth program. The Minnesota Wing, I think many of you are probably familiar with them, and some of you may even be legislative members, has many significant accomplishments, and one of the more significant ones occurred in 1999 when CAP was credited with 19 lives saved during the Boundary Water Blowdown disaster. I think I remember that one for sure. So the members of the Wing provide thousands of volunteer hours in their local communities each year, and the value of those hours to the state of Minnesota in 2015 was estimated at over $4.1 million. There are 19 cap-powered aircraft located around the state that must be maintained and kept ready for emergency operations 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. To ensure the availability and the standardization of these aircraft, the wing needs a central maintenance and training facility. In 2005, Minnesota Wing completed construction of phase one of the facility at the South St. Paul Airport, Fleming Field, which has been working well but is too small for the fleet. And so, Mr. Chair, with that, I'd like to turn it over to our testifier just to speak briefly on some of the technical components.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Colonel James Garlow. I'm the commander of the Minnesota Wing of the Civil Air Patrol, and I'm here today to provide some information on our project. Thank you, folks, for taking the time to hear what we have to say today. Our initial phase of the project began in 2005, and it was originally designed as a two-phase project. Unfortunately, with the funding we had at the time and a dramatic increase in the cost of steel, we were only able to complete slightly more than half of the original hangar. We can put about seven of the aircraft in there if we need to. Unfortunately, even then, it was too small. It contains no space for training or for any other type of activity other than the aircraft maintenance. There's a very small office in one corner, and that's it. In order to provide the adequate space to maintain the equipment that we have to maintain for our missions, we need to finish the hangar to the original size of 100 by 100, which will require putting a 40-foot extension on the front of it. It was always planned for that, and in fact, the building was designed to allow that. And then the training facility next to it, which will provide the space for additional classrooms where we can provide STEM education and readiness education for our search teams. Just so you know, we stand ready 24/7 to be on search missions. We are actively on a search and rescue mission right now. I got the notification about an hour ago, and that's an ELT that is going off somewhere near the Anoka Airport. So I don't know exactly what the status is because I'm here, but we're out doing our job 24/7, 365. The basic cost of the expansion of the hangar, including some things that have to be done, some technical things that have to be done in order to move it, including the in-floor heating, will cost about $600,000. The total cost, roughly, of the construction and finishing of the training center, based upon the two bids I've seen so far, and this is an average of them, is 1.5. And then there's some additional things on the list that you do have in the packets. I believe you were given that information today, Mr. Chair. We also provide, and I just want to, it's sort of an addition, but I want to highlight that we provide a backup communication system to the state and to the entire region with HF radios. We have repeater sites for VHF throughout the state. I believe there's 23 repeaters right now. I could be wrong about the number, so don't quote me. But there's those and then the HF radios. And we have found in a couple of instances in the past that we were the only communication source into and out of a disaster area. For example, the blowdown. For about 24 hours, we were the best communications into and out of that area. And we need to bolster that and provide a mobile communications platform, which is a part of this as well. Very small part. With that, I think it may be best if there are any questions.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so this needs to be cash because it's a nonprofit and not publicly owned. Is that correct?
Yes, Representative, that's correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just describe the aircraft, the type of aircraft that you have for us?
Yes,
Colonel Garlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have Cessna 182s and 172s. The mix right now, off the top of my head, I believe we have 14 Cessna 172 four-place single-engine aircraft. They're high-wing so that we can see down quite a bit with them. The 182s are a very similar configuration, but they're slightly larger and more powerful. And we have one GA-8, which is a Gippsland aircraft manufactured in Australia, and it is an 8-passenger single-engine aircraft with extraordinary visibility. It's also a high-wing aircraft. And in addition to that, we didn't list them here, but we have 5 gliders that we use for training of young people learning how to fly, in addition to the Cessna 172s.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I do not see any other questions. Representative Barr, you have done a wonderful job of properly bringing yourself to the committee for the first time and providing us with what I would interpret as Lucky Charm muffins.
Yes, well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
It just reinforces my knowledge that the members of this committee are far superior to the members of any other committee. So, if you'd like to make any closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. I think that this is an amazing facility that provides a great service through volunteers to our great state of Minnesota, and I would respectfully ask for your support in laying this over for possible, or approving this for possible inclusion. Thank you.
So are you renewing your motion, Representative Barr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to renew my motion.
House File 1984 is laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Next, we have Representative Albright's bill, House File 1990. Welcome to committee, Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, good afternoon.
Would you care to introduce your bill?
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. I'll move your bill first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to move House File 1990 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, transit funding switched from the property tax in 2001. The suburban providers were allocated a percentage of the MBEST based upon the property taxes collected for transit in our respective service areas. In 2008, the legislature expanded the MBEST amount dedicated to transit in the metropolitan area from 21.5% to 36%, which still exists today. Unfortunately, that legislation didn't incorporate the suburban planner providers who provide regional services, which are Plymouth Metrolink, Maple Grove Transit, Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, and Southwest Transit. Since there was no guaranteed increase for the suburban providers in the 2008 legislation, unlike the metropolitan area, the suburban providers who qualify under the current Metropolitan Council policies have only been able to grow by roughly 3% per year. This cap of 3% has made it impossible for suburban provider systems to keep pace with ridership demands in their service area, but at the same time, other portions of the metropolitan area have expanded with either LRT or BRT. And Mr. Chair, with that, the purpose of the bill is to rectify that and to initiate the conversation between the stakeholders on that very subject. And I have 2 testifiers that are happy to provide additional testimony and answer your question.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to address the committee this afternoon. My name is Len Simich. I'm the CEO of Southwest Transit. The Twin Cities suburban transit providers are requesting a modification to the current motor vehicle sales tax formula that is used to fund metro area transit. This request is being made because we have really not been able to grow our services since 2001. Meanwhile, both households as well as the number of jobs in our service area have continued to grow at a very rapid rate. As Representative Albright mentioned, prior to 2001, the metro area transit was funded through the property tax, and that switch happened after 2001 to the motor vehicle sales tax. At that time, 21.5% of all the MBEST funding was designated for metro area transit, and that was split out legislatively to the transit providers. The suburban transit providers received 3.74% of that total, and the remaining 17.76% was split between Metro Transit and the Metropolitan Council. The actual funding distribution created by this split, and there is a handout that depicts this a little bit, basically had 17.39% of the actual dollars or the cash that was available for transit operations in the metro area going to the suburban providers, with the remaining 82.61% going to Metro Transit and the Metropolitan Council. And this is depicted in chart number 1 and 2 of the handout. Shortly after the change was made with the transit funding using MBEST revenues, it was evident that the funding was falling very short of what we had all hoped for. Therefore, in 2007, the MDES funding dedicated to the Metropolitan Area Transit was increased by the legislature from the 21.5% up to 36%. The suburban transit systems worked very hard to get this change, and we had thought at that time that the same funding allocation would carry forward. But unfortunately, it's not been the case. Again, as depicted by the handouts on chart 3 and 4, you can see how the distribution played out in 2016. Now, each year, the totals may move slightly, but 2016, I think, provides a good example of how the funding has been allocated. I will point out, as we go into 2017, it appears that the allocation to the suburban providers will actually go down a little bit, down to about 11%. So therefore, we are requesting this legislative change, which would guarantee the suburban transit systems the same percentage allocation of the 36% of the MVES as it was done back when this was initially enacted back in 2001, and that is shown in graphs 5 and 6. With that, I'm going to conclude my testimony, and I have Luther Winder, the Executive Director of Minnesota Valley, talk a little bit more about what this actually would do for our systems.
Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This is Luther Winder, Executive Director for Minnesota Valley Transit Authority. I really want to reiterate what this is for. This modification is necessary in order for us as suburban providers to keep pace with the same growth that's being seen in the metro area. As regional transit providers, and that's something that the council espouses that we are, that we believe we are, we should have the same opportunities to serve our customers as do our metro brothers and sisters have. And currently with this allocation, the constitutional amendment that was done in 2008, and when that percentage didn't obviously translate to our suburban providers, we've been unable to do that. That is kind of, as you've seen in the past historically, you've seen us last year and year before really talking about additional funding from the legislature for our suburban service. That was, perhaps of that is because we simply did not have the funds necessary to expand our services. Now you'll hear testimony probably in the future talking about obviously the need for the deficits in this particular region. But understand this, that suburban providers, the two largest, are capped at 3% growth rate. We necessarily, from this standpoint, this is needed for us obviously to expand our services, but also to grow our services to meet our needs. Not necessarily for us to obviously do some other more controversial things. But I just want to also kind of highlight that when you look at the growth in the South Metro and in the suburban metro area, jobs are translating there, as well as individuals are traversing there. So we want to make sure that we have strong transit options that allow us to transport those individuals to those places of employment, as well as transport the individuals who currently reside or are moving there back into the city core. Thank you.
Thank you. I do not Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if any of the three can answer my question or whether you need someone else. But there's a two-sided sheet that was distributed, and it says regional transit route performance analysis data. One side shows the subsidy per passenger. The other side shows fare box recovery. Does somebody?
Yeah, we have
you,
it.
You all have it. Can someone identify, because you're here on behalf of just a few corridors, can you identify on this list which are yours that you're seeking additional funding for?
Mr. Sinek.
Mr. Chair, Representative, actually the funding we're seeking is for all the suburban providers. I represent Southwest Transit.
Right, that's why you're not maybe the right person, maybe the author. Is it about five lines or... Because I thought it would be helpful for members to know which of these are we talking about when they're presenting, and what is their subsidy per passenger, and what is their fare box recovery. So whoever could give us.
Representative Albright. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hausman. It is actually the four systems that we are asking for the rate increase for. And so those would be for Plymouth Metrolink, the Maple Grove Transit, Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, and Southwest Transit.
And not Shakopee?
Shakopee is included in Minnesota Valley Transit Authority.
Is the same as Minnesota Valley and Shakopee have have the same. So when we, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Representative Hauser, can you just pull your mic down a little bit? Thank you.
I bet I have to bend it. So when we see if Minnesota Valley Transit Authority and Shakopee have been combined, here they show like subsidy per passenger for Minnesota Valley is $9.21 per passenger. Shakopee is $10.94. So what would we assume? Do you know what it would be in the combined system?
This number,
Mr. Weiner.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. These numbers, this analysis is based on 2015. This is prior to the merger, before Minnesota Valley merged with Shakopee and Prior Lake Service. So at that particular time, those were the passenger per hour and the fare cost recovery for those two cities. Since then, they've obviously incorporated into the Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, and those numbers will be updated shortly to show you the 2016.
And so, Mr. Chair, just clarifying then, so the fare box recovery for the Shakopee line was 4%, and the fare box recovery for Minnesota Valley Transit Authority was 10.
Mr. Chair, based on 2015 prior to the merger, yes.
Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, one of the things as I look at that, that coincidentally we're seeking the increased funding for really what seem to be already some of the highest subsidized per passenger and the lowest fare box recovery of all of transit. What, help me with that.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
And Representative Hausman, I think one of the components that is missing from that analogy is the cap on expansion. And so if we are afforded the opportunity to grow at a rate larger than what has been fixed in the statute, I think that you would not identify that the fare box recovery would also be increased volumetrically.
Representative Hausman.
And just remembering a bill that was heard in the other committee and not in ours, I don't know if it's coming here, there was a proposal have a 60% fare box recovery on Metro Transit. What would happen to you if you had to have a 60% fare box recovery?
Representative Alder.
If that were to occur, I think that the benefit would be inured to the state for the benefit of revenues generated by systems that have cost the state an innumerable amount of money.
What would happen to ridership?
Representative Hausman.
What would happen to ridership?
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hausman, I think the consideration of fare box recovery on rapid transit buses or express buses in this case would I think, be increased as well, as you would see an increase in the number of riders.
And Mr. Chair, my frustration about the Suburban Transit Association, the history of that, there was a time when there were some suburbs who felt they were getting no transit service, and so they asked to opt out, saying they would pay for theirs themselves with their own property taxes. And then there was a decision at one point we were going to move away from property taxes, and that meant these particular lines were grandfathered in, but now they were enabled then to have their own transit associations and their own planning. And we have a situation now where different elements of the seven county metro area end up sort of being at war with one another, which is never a good thing. I mean, it's always better if we all benefit together, we make the case together, we speak with a single voice, and perhaps if we all work together and spoke with a single voice, we would be more successful at increased funding for the entire system.
Mr. Chair, I'll just leave you with the point that the conversation continues. And the purpose of House File 1990 is to generate a consideration and conversation amongst the stakeholders moving towards some type of correction or adjustment in the funding mechanism for those four providers.
Thank you. Representative Mason.
Thank you. I was just going to ask the testifiers maybe to give some background on some of the buses that you're using and the capacity. Like how many people are standing on the buses, et cetera, just because of the problems that you've had with the funding.
Okay. Mr. Stenick.
Mr. Chair, Representative,
Yes, thank you for the question. One thing, if I can just go back just briefly to Representative Hausman, sometimes what you're looking at doesn't tell the whole story. What you're seeing as Express, for example, is not only Express that is going from our communities really to benefit the two downtown areas. That is where the bread and butter of our service goes. That is the buses that you're talking about, Representative, that are full, and we do have standees. What also gets wrapped into that is the services that we're trying to promote in a reverse commute method. And in a case like ours, where I come out of Chaska, which is one of the longest, if not the longest, routes in the whole metro area, you know, we're going over 30 miles one way, and that door is shut because we're running Express after we leave, primarily Eden Prairie. So, of course, it's going to look in terms of a cost standpoint, but I can tell you that the cost structures that we have in place is far less than what you see in other providers here in the metro area, in terms of what the wages that are paid, the number of mechanics, and so on and so forth. So it is probably the most efficient. But when you wrap in that Express or some of the Title VI services or some of the what we have, what we call TAILS, to provide that local, and we're doing it with an Express bus rather than a separate bus, it skews the bottom line. If you look at just our Express, we probably have some of the best, most effective services out there on the street today, with recovery rates well above 35%, and in some cases it's above 40%. So to answer your question, it's kind of a roundabout way, on that Express portion, again, taking people into the downtowns from a pure work purpose, those buses are extremely full.
Thank you, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Albright. So if the suburban opt-outs get more money, who's going to get less money? And so, therefore, who's going to get less service? And the reason I ask this is I represent Brooklyn Park, and Maple Grove Transit's right across the border from my district. And they seem to have better service there. They have commuter service. They have a circulator bus that goes through Maple Grove and brings people around. We don't have that in Brooklyn Park because we're not an opt-out. So who's going to get less service? And so if we have this handful of opt-outs getting more service, does that mean everyone else is going to have to cut or live with cuts in service?
Representative Albright?
I will let my testifiers explain.
Mr. Simic.
Mr. Chair, Representative. It's a very good and a fair question. I know Metro Council, Metro Transit has bills going forward that would put additional funding into the operations. Whether or not that they would have to make up any, you know, differences in service cuts, that's really kind of up to them how they would go about that. I will tell you, from your service area, you would be one of the areas that would benefit probably the greatest, because your area is one of those that we have targeted where there's a high number of people that are either unemployed or underemployed, and we have the jobs out in that Southwest corridor, and we're trying to link services up to the Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center area. So I think, again, you don't want to create winners and losers, but, yes, if there was no additional funding or nothing else changed, Metro Transit, Metro Council would have to figure out how they would come up with that difference.
Representative Nelson.
So you said exactly what it is. They even have to cut service because that's the only place they have to cut money. And we've seen multiple bills here cutting funding to Metropolitan Council or messing with Metropolitan Council's way of providing transit services. So in the discussion you had about trying to get people from Brooklyn Park down there, we have a plethora of businesses up there that all have help wanted signs hung out on them. And so, I mean, I've had those discussions with other representatives in the legislature about looking at that. But they're talking about charging large amounts of money that these people can't afford to get right now, and making them get to the Mall of America before they get on that service going out there, which means they have to use the existing service. But if we cut that because we're giving your service more money, we're cutting over here, they're not going to be able to get to the Mall of America to be able to do that. So, Mr. Chair, this is a way of, there's not enough money here. This is another episode of, or example of us, everyone at the table, fighting over the scraps instead of properly funding a system that we need that probably should be expanded and properly funding it so that we have the service we need so all of our people can get to work, to jobs, to their doctors, to their grocery stores, and do the things they have to do if they're not able to drive. So, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to be supporting this bill.
Thank you, President Nelson. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I want to echo some of what Representative Nelson said. And first of all, I mean, we need this service. It's a good service. The Marshall Road facility is a good one. I want to see it used even more than it's used now. I support transit. I support transit in the suburbs. But I believe that Representative Nelson's point was a good one because we can go back to 2011, and the bill then had a lot of cuts to Metro Transit, and the opt-outs were left either whole or even got an increase. And I hope we don't go down that road when we put together our bill here. Because, again, we don't want to pick winners and losers. We want all modes, roads, bridges, transit, suburbs, Metro Transit funded. I think there's enough resources to go around to do that. So just a word of caution. As we put our bill together, I really want to make sure that that everyone benefits. And if we go down the road that I fear we're going down, that Representative Nelson talked about, it's not going to be a very helpful way to do transportation. So I do support your work, and you're doing a good job. And these new routes that like the 495 that you have are helpful. But we can't be supporting that at the expense of someone else.
Mr. Widener.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I just want to just go back and really look at what this bill is. It's a modification for the existing infrastructure, something that was done in, if the percentage was carried through in 2008, we wouldn't need to have this conversation. You're correct. We should not be talking about winners and losers, but we should also recognize that there are different service types that are provided by different providers. And some service types cost more money than other service types do. And when you're dealing with a particular pie, you have to ask yourself, is that service type, does that service type, say, bus rapid transit, cost more than local services? Does that take up predominantly more of that particular pie than, say, your express service? So when we look at that, that's what we want to understand, that as we go through and as our planners and as our boards and as our councils make these decisions, we want the ability, obviously, not only to have an appropriate share, which we should hopefully have, but also, too, to continue to put out those service types that we believe, as Lynn talked about, and I want to touch on as well, too, we would give the most value, the most service concentration, but also at some of the lowest cost. When you look at our fare box recovery and subject passenger tell one side of the story, look at our operational costs and the service tax that we put out on the street, and that tells a completely different side of the story as well, too, that we are looking to continue not to expand services per se, but we're also looking to right-size the services based on our particular regions. And I just want to leave that. I just want to also leave you guys with that.
Follow-up, Representative Hornstein?
No, thanks.
I believe we need to hear from the Met Council representative, who seems to be waiting in the wings. Welcome to committee. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Judd Shetton, the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council, and here to speak to House Bill 1990. And what I'd like to say, Mr. Chair and members, is how these funds are distributed. Is we've talked about this in this committee many times before, that when the council receives its funds, we get general fund and we get motor vehicle sales tax. We use the general fund to pay the Metro Mobility portion of what is needed. Then we pay light rail, since those are two things that are statutorily required. What's left remaining in the general fund is combined with the MBEST, and that is then distributed to the different partners. And what we have here is a situation where we have a zero-sum game. And as one of the testifiers mentioned, is that there hasn't been any expansion in bus. We haven't had any expansion in bus either. And so what this is doing is treating one provider or providers differently than the others. And what concerns me is that on Tuesday we made a presentation that brought forward a funding proposal that would fund everybody. This proposal doesn't do that. In fact, this proposal would take money from the regional transit, bus transit system, and provide it only to certain partners. And that is not the approach that we've taken and how we have asked the legislature how to review this, and that is why we oppose this bill. Now, what I'd be curious to see is what the, and maybe I missed this, but what the percentage that is being looked at provided to these providers would be on line 1.21, because whatever happens there, that will be a reduction in what we're able to do in our regular out bus, because, again, whatever we receive from the state, we pay for the light rail operations, which is law, and for Metro Mobility operations, which is law. So when we shift this percentage over, it goes against what we have left to pay for our regular out bus. And, Mr. Chair, with that, you know, I can take some questions if you'd like. I think I know the detail on how everything transitioned from 2001 to 2008 when the constitutional amendment came in. I can go into all that detail if you'd want. I was here for it, but I get the impression you probably don't. So just to try to hit the high points here, there is some trouble with this bill when we're treating some folks different than others.
Thank you, Mr. Shetland. This is a Transportation Committee, not a history class.
Yes.
And I do not see any member questions. Representative Albright, would you care to make any closing remarks?
Mr. Chair and members, I think you've heard the conversation has been engaged between the stakeholders. And as Mr. Shetland pointed out, there is a blank in the language, and that is specifically for the stakeholders to dialogue about, and I would appreciate your consideration as you mark up your transportation bill.
Thank you, Representative Albright. I renew my motion that House File 1990 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, we have Representative West's bill 1496. Welcome to the committee, Representative West. I see that you are making your contribution to our waistlines. I appreciate that. Please introduce your bill and go ahead. All right, wait a minute. I need to move your bill, don't I?
Please.
I would like to move that House File 1496 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1496 is a study of Trunk Highway 65, which runs through my district, and it's a study starting at Anoka County Highway 10, which was amended in the last committee by Representative Bernardi, and then it goes all the way up to County Road 116, which is Bunker Lake Boulevard. And I have a testifier with me, Doug Fisher. He is the Anoka County engineer, and he can go briefly into a little more detail on why this is necessary.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug Fisher. I'm the Anoka County Engineer and Transportation Division Manager. In addition, I am the administrative representative for the North Trunk Highway 65 Corridor Coalition. So today I am supporting this bill on behalf of Anoka County and the North Trunk Highway 65 Corridor Coalition, of which you should have received a letter of support in your packet. If you're not familiar with Trunk Highway 65, it is a major north-south principal arterial highway, not only through the center of Anoka County in our cities of Columbia Heights, Hilltop, Fridley, Spring Lake Park, Blaine, Ham Lake, and East Bethel, but it's a route that starts in Minneapolis and extends all the way up to International Falls. Along the way is the primary north-south route for communities such as Cambridge, Mora, McGregor, just to name a few. Certainly the route up through Mora is a very dependent as a commuter route for businesses and residents to the Twin Cities. This route is in the study area is classified as an expressway, and it has numerous signalized intersections along the way. Within the study area, you may be familiar with some of our larger land uses on this corridor, including the National Sports Center, the Blaine and Anoka County Regional Airport, and the TPC of the Twin Cities, which is home of the 3M Championship PGA Senior Tour event. If you look at the traffic volumes in the study area proposed by this bill, you'll see that the vehicle per day volume is about 53,000 vehicles per day. As a county engineer, a number like that does jump out at me as being very significant, but for your comparison and the other handout that should be in your packet, I compared that to other highway segments in Anoka County for comparison on traffic volumes. And if you look at that exhibit, you'll see that this corridor that we're looking at has roughly the same highway volumes as segments in Anoka County on Interstate 35W and Interstate 35E. And if you can imagine the interstates having signals every half to a mile spacing apart, you realize what a disaster that would be. Well, that's the type of traffic volumes we're talking about on this section of Highway 65. If you look at the crash data for this section of Highway 65, you'll find equally or even more disturbing results. In the 10-year period from 2006 to 2015, the segment, the 20-mile segment from 85th Avenue, which is the very southern end of the study area, to the North County line, we had 86 fatal and incapacitating injuries on this corridor. 86. So that is very alarming as well. I will note that MnDOT and the Met Council are now wrapping up a study that they did called the Principal Arterial Intersection Conversion Study, where they're looking at these non-freeway type principal arterials that have lots of signals and lots of traffic and lots of crashes, and trying to figure out how they can prioritize and make improvements on those. This corridor is one of only two corridors in that study that every signalized intersection showed up as a high priority intersection that should be addressed. And on the back of the map, you can see another exhibit that shows, based on the mainline traffic volumes and the side street traffic volumes, when an at-grade signalized intersection begins to break down. And you can see that every intersection in this study area far exceeds that threshold, and so that's why this study is so important. This corridor has been studied before, so why are we asking for money to study it again? And that is because we have new tools in the toolbox. Over the last even half decade, we have new hybrid interchanges that can address the majority of the crash and congestion issues at a much smaller cost. We did a similar study to Highway 10 in the western port of Anoka County, and we could address over 90% of the capacity and safety issues at half the cost of a traditional freeway conversion. So that's the type of study that we're looking for here, to address those capacity, mobility, safety, and business continuity issues on this corridor, with trying to apply these new innovative hybrid interchanges or other high-capacity intersection improvements. And having this information will allow us to move forward to create those high-value, low-cost solutions to address these many needs. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe you and I are in the wrong business when there's a study that costs $600,000. Can you kind of get, it doesn't have to be real detailed, but can you tell me who's getting that $600,000 to do a traffic study? That's a lot of money.
Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, studies like this, I would say, like on the Highway 10 study that we did, it was a partnership with MnDOT and Anoka County financially, and then also as far as the cities along that corridor, Anoka, Ramsey, also were involved in that study. Study like this, we would hire a consultant, so the money would go to pay a consultant to assist both the Department of Transportation and the county in doing this. It is a very intensive effort. There's a lot of public involvement. Obviously, this is a very commercial corridor. It's going to have some access issues. Taking a signalized intersection and putting in a grade separation may have very adverse results for those immediately in the intersection, but much greater benefit for those on the corridor. So it takes a lot of effort. This can take 12, 15, 18 months of time to do this, to get that business coordination, to get the community and public participation, along with the good old-fashioned engineering that I like to do, but also that public coordination process is very intense as well in studies like these.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had the opportunity to drive this road last summer. and I know what you're talking about. I was amazed at the complexity of it, and just trying to get a snack and trying to get to a restaurant, and it was a challenge for me, maybe. But my question is for the author, and, you know, this is a good example of a road that needs some, not only a study, but needs the work that goes with it. I can't imagine what it will cost to really fix this road. We need more roads, road money, and it's generally recognized that we need at least $600 million a year to meet the needs of roads like this. And so I'm asking the author, are you willing to support new taxes that would provide new constitutionally dedicated money, such as in a gas tax and or tab fee increase, to provide that money to build roads like this?
Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm here to discuss my bill, not other bills, so I'd like to keep the discussion primarily to the merits of this piece of legislation.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is going to take a lot of money, and the question, what he was asking, are you prepared to support this and to get a bill out that will pay for the job? That comes with the territory.
Representative, before you answer, Representative West, members, I'm not going to cut you off, but we do have a lot of ground to cover. I would like to get through all these bills today. I would like to keep the discussion narrowly focused on the bill at hand. Representative West.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Mason. Yes, I would support a bill to pay for this.
President Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As mentioned, this does go through my district, and thank you for being here, Mr. Fisher, and for your work in Anoka County that I represent. But I did want to mention for Representative Johnson, we had talked about this, and this is a corridor. It reminded me of 14. We always hear about the safety. And Highway 65 and Central Avenue has been known to be, I mean, the word bloodbath has been used before. But I was talking to Mr. Fisher, and I was explaining this to him and how there is a consensus that we know 14 is a dangerous place. And do you mind if I say what you said this is like? You didn't say no. Highway 65 is like 14 on steroids when it comes to safety issues. So this is too, and that's why we do need funding and support to really make our roads safe everywhere.
We'll have to do a study to see if your claim is
Mr. Chair, actually, we're working on it. Mr. Fisher's working on it.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I drive this corridor a lot. I go to the National Sports Center more times than I'd like to count. But it seems to me that the way it's configured, it's built up right to the roadway. And I don't know how you get around that in making it safer with the existing businesses right there on the road already.
Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, we had a very similar situation further north up at Main Street, or it was old Trunk Highway 242, now it's our County State Highway 14. Signal was in the top five worst intersections in the state of Minnesota. And we were successfully able to change that from an at-grade signal to a grade-separated interchange. And we also removed the signalized intersections north and south of that primary intersection. Just had bridges going over, no access there, but we built a single-point diamond at that intersection. There were some businesses that had to be bought out, relocated, but... and again, that was more of a traditional type of an interchange, although single-point diamonds are kind of a hybrid too. But with some of the things out there now with high tees and different things, we can, again, they're a little more, their footprint is smaller, and we feel that we can do that. Again, it won't go without some impact. There will be some impact. But again, we have done this before as an example up at at Main Street, 125th Avenue and Blaine. We made that successful conversion, and what we're trying to do is replicate that down the line here.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer. And it's going to be really, really expensive, but, you know, if it makes my life easier, getting to the sports center.
Thank you. Representative West, any closing remarks?
Thank you, Chair. And to Representative Rosenthal's point, we do have the National Sports Center adjacent to this property, which drives tens of thousands of people across this road, not necessarily just people from Blaine, but people from all over the state. And I'd like to thank the committee for the support of this project.
Thank you, Representative. I'd like to renew my motion that House File 1496 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we're going to get mine.
Which one do you want to go to? 1571. Transportation won't forgive us. Welcome to the table, Mr. Chair. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll start with House File 1871. I move it to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Please go right ahead and explain your bill.
Thank you. 1871 deals with a loan forgiveness for the Minnesota Valley Regional Rail Authority. The amount of the loan is $4.3 million. I have a testifier here who will be happy to fill in some details.
Welcome, Commissioner, and please identify yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Mike Beard from Shakopee, Minnesota. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Valley Regional Rail Authority, which is a consortium of five counties consisting of Yellow Medicine, Sibley, Redwood, Renville, Carver counties. They it formed in the late 1990s to buy 94 miles of abandoned track from the Chicago Northwestern Railroad. I'd like to emphasize this is a freight railroad that serves a highly agricultural community. During the formation years, actually Chicago Northwestern Railroad abandoned the track in 1984, and the counties on the west end out around Dawson and Madison actually did form their rail authority and purchased the line west of the Burlington Northern Main Line and protected the soybean mill at Hanley, or at at Dawson and Madison. The line to the east, the 94 miles, was purchased by an entrepreneurial group that ran it for a few years and pretty much ran it into the ground and couldn't make a go of it. So the five counties finally saw the wisdom of forming a joint powers board, and with some assistance from the shippers, from their county tax base, and from the state of Minnesota, purchased the line. And in 2002, they acquired a loan for about $5 million from MnDOT from what we call the Mercy Fund. Now, you've heard a little about the Mercy Fund yesterday, today, and probably next week when you meet again. You'll hear bills regarding the Mercy Fund. MRSI stands for Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Fund, which was created, I believe, during the Ventura years. And we do have witnesses here from the Department of Transportation's Freight Rail Office if you need to hear more detail about that. I'll just give you the quick overview. It was created while the short line railroads were being formed after the Staggers Rail Act in the 80s. Now, I know, Mr. Chairman, you said no history, but you kind of have to understand how this whole thing came together. So this fund had a general fund appropriation during the Ventura administration of about $10 million. About $5 million of it was loaned to these five counties for a 15-year term, which expires this summer. There was a mechanism to pay it back on basically a performance basis. Once they exceeded 8,000 carloads per year, the rate would jump to about $50 a carload. They haven't exceeded 8,000 cars a year yet. They've been running around 6,000 carloads a year, which is hugely important to the economies of these five counties, but hasn't triggered the faster payback, hasn't made it possible yet. And so the loan is due, and what this bill asked for is to convert the loan to a grant, which is permitted under the Mercy Program and is within your purview to do. I should emphasize, because I'm anticipating the question already, Mr. Chairman and Committee, this does not impact your targets, because this money has already been appropriated by a previous legislature in about 1998 or 99, and this is not bond money, it's general fund money, although the Rail Authority is obligated under the statutes to not parcel out the property, or if they ever do go out of business and sell, the money has to revert to the state. So that's sort of the quick overview of what the bill does. It gets the Rail Authority off the indebtedness, out of the indebted position to the Department of Transportation, It does affect the Department of Transportation's freight rail office. It maybe affects their balance sheet, but certainly not their cash flow, and it certainly doesn't hit your general fund targets. So with that, perhaps it would be better to respond to questions you're concerned about instead of giving.
Thank you, Mr. Bearden. We do have at least a couple. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this is just, a simple question. I just want a clarification. The fiscal note has 4.13, and this is for 4.3. Is that, what's the, anyone know the reason why there's a difference there?
Chair Torkelson or Mr. Lee, I think you have the answer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the fiscal note, if you look on page 2, the second paragraph notes that there is $4.129 million remaining in the Mercy Fund. So this would spend that down as there's nothing left.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I just want to remind the committee that we still have, I think, four bills yet to go, and we have about 45 minutes. So just keep that in mind. I don't think any of us want to stay here longer today. But any other questions? If not, Chair Torkelson, would you like to have the final word?
I'd just like to renew my motion that House File 1871 be laid over for possible inclusion.
It is laid over. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Next up, Mr. Chair, we have House File 859. This is a department bill, and I have an able-bodied representative from the department here to present the details of the bill.
Would you like to move that bill?
I would like to move House File 859 for possible inclusion.
Go right ahead and introduce.
No, don't mean we're going to send a ways.
Just a minute. There may be some
possibly
confusion.
I made the wrong motion, Mr. Chair.
Bear with us for a minute. We are interpreting where it needs to go. We don't want to make a mistake.
No,
when
the real chair leaves the chair, things go off the rail.
859 the way.
I've been told that the correct motion would be for this to be moved, re-referred to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I withdraw my motion and accept yours.
Okay. Chair Torkelson has moved this bill to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, so please introduce this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Verdeen with MnDOT Government Affairs. Sections 1 and 6 of the bill remove Trunk Highway 112 from the state highway system and transfer jurisdiction to Le Sueur County. And there's a resolution of support from the Le Sueur County Board coming around for that. This highway is about 15 miles long, and since all trunk highways are listed in statute, the legislature must take action to repeal or amend the route description before it can be turned over to a local government. And ensuring that the roads are on the right system, meaning the state or local system, leads to better efficiency for maintenance and construction of these roads. Section 2 of the bill authorizes the sale of property to adjacent landowners if the original landowner does not wish to repurchase the property once the department determines it's no longer needed for a trunk highway purpose. Sections 3 and 4 help with the conveyance of property, again, when it is no longer needed for a trunk highway purpose. We go through a process where first we offer it to local governments and then to the former landowner, and then we go to public bid, but there are cases where we do not receive any public bids. So with this proposed change, the property can be listed on the department's website with the minimum bid price, and then anybody could find it on the website and purchase it. Section 5 allows MnDOT to convey the McKinstry Mounds property to the Minnesota Historical Society. This site is approximately 8 acres and contains an Indian burial mound. Section 7 turns jurisdiction of Highway 225 over to Becker County, and this highway is approximately 9 miles long and serves mainly local interests. And then Section 8 deletes a description of Legislative Route 101 from the statutes. This is not Highway 101. It's actually a portion of Interstate 35 in Dakota County and Rice County, and there is a duplicative numbering of that section of freeway that remained from a turnback that occurred in the 1990s, and so this is actually just a cleanup of the statute.
just pitch that one on her.
I mentioned the Section 6 of the bill is, I think I mentioned at the beginning when I was talking about the language in Section 1 related to turning back from Highway 112.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, do you have any other comments?
No, I do not, Mr. Chair. I'd like to renew my motion that House File 859 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
So done. And it is laid over.
No.
I'm sorry. I was thinking, yeah, you got me confused from before. The motion is we laid over, and now we're going to Ways and Means, now we're going back to Ways and Means. So the motion as presented was that this will be moved to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed? That motion prevails. Now we can get to a layover, right?
Thank you. The next bill, House File 861, I'd like to move this bill to be laid over for possible inclusion. And again, I have the able-bodied representative of the Minnesota Department of Transportation here to present the bill.
Continue on, Mr. Radin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 1 of the bill removes a sunset on 6% bid preference that's available for targeted group businesses and veteran-owned businesses. The statute currently provides that this preference is only available for 8 years, and it's important for these small businesses to be able to continue receiving that preference. These are for projects that are 100% state funded, which is a small number of our projects, because most of our projects have federal funds associated with them, and there's a separate program for projects involving federal funds. Section 2 updates state statute to allow milk trucks to travel on interstates. These trucks have been able to obtain a special permit, but have been prohibited from operating on the interstates until Congress took a recent action to allow them on interstates, and so this would also allow them in state law. Section 3 amends the statute so that certain speeding violations, which we sometimes refer to as Dimmler violations, are no longer masked for holders of a learner's permit for a commercial driver's license. The federal government requires that individuals with commercial driver's license or even a learner's permit for a commercial driver's license be held to a higher standard, and that any moving violation go on that driver's record. Sections 4 and 5 of the bill change the schedule for the statewide multimodal transportation plan and the 20-year capital highway investment plan from every 4 years to every 5 years. And this would allow us more time to implement what's in the plans before we go out and begin the next cycle of updating the plans. These were previously on a 6-year cycle, and then they were changed to a 4-year cycle, and we're finding that that's maybe a little too frequent, so we're asking to go to a 5-year cycle. Section 6 requires that yield signs be installed at railroad crossings when stop signs or other devices are not present. And that's a change that was made in the 2009 federal manual on uniform traffic control devices, and so this would bring our state statute into line with that, and it requires that they be installed by December 2019. And finally, Section 7 exempts pipeline welding trucks from most federal motor carrier safety regulations, and this was a provision in the recent federal FAST Act, and Congress exempted these vehicles from those regulations, and so we now have to bring our state statute into conformance with the federal change.
Any other questions, Marty? If not, Chair Tarkelson, would you like to
Thank Bernardi? You. No? I'd like to renew my motion that House File 861 be laid over for possible inclusion.
It is laid over. And with that, we've had a majority, we have had a quorum for quite a while, so Representative Johnson, do you have any information in regards to the March 7th minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the minutes from March 7th.
All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Next we have House File 1550, Representative Becker.
Some motion on this.
Welcome to committee. Representative Backer, I'd like to move House File 1550 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Chair. Members, I'll be brief and let our testifiers. Basically, what 1550 does is it takes money, general fund money, and creates two accounts. One is for small cities under 5,000, and the other one is cities of 5,000 or greater. Cities for 5,000 and less, we use the same formula that was passed about 2 years ago. We just doubled the money from $12.5 to $25 million. And then cities from 5,000 or greater, it's based on a need base instead of population. And really, the main reason for this bill is we have town streets, city streets that are in need of repair, and I believe it's the responsibility of the state to also help our partners, which are cities. We, as the state, I was mayor, I know and understand how much mandates and other things that the state puts on counties and cities, and I just think this is a good partnership. So with that said, I'm going to turn over to our testifiers.
Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rick Blake, and I'm a city councilor for the city of Grand Rapids. Grand Rapids is a community of just over 11,000 people in Itasca County. As a city of over 5,000, we do receive municipal street aid from the state. However, just like cities of all sizes across Minnesota, we are having trouble keeping up with our street repair. We would like to thank Representative Backer for bringing forward House File 1550 to help cities of all sizes maintain their streets. I've provided the committee with a handout with detailed information about Grand Rapids city streets. The cost of maintaining our city streets has risen much faster than our ability to pay, whether through property taxes, local government aid, or municipal street aid. We have supported creating street improvement districts, but the legislature has not granted us that authority. 2 years ago, a referendum calling for local sales tax for street repair was narrowly defeated. We plan to try that again, but even when it passes, we will need legislative authorization to make that happen. We see the cost of properly maintaining city streets as the single greatest threat to the financial health of our community. We are here today to ask for your support for additional street aid because we simply cannot raise the money ourselves. I remember many years ago traveling the $1 million highway in Colorado, so named because back in the day, it cost an amazing $1 million a mile to build through the Rockies. Well, times have changed. The cost to reconstruct a flat mile of street in Grand Rapids is now $2.6 million. That means an annual cost of $7.8 million for the 3 miles called for in our street maintenance plan. Keeping our property tax rate at a reasonable level has meant that we have been unable to bond for the dollars required to properly maintain streets while maintaining a reasonable level of city services like police, fire, snow removal, etc. Our increasing backlog of streets requiring repair also means that a greater portion will require reconstruction, when if addressed earlier, a less expensive overlay might have been sufficient. The City of Grand Rapids has tried to budget for sufficient funds to repair our streets on a timely and cost-efficient schedule, but we are falling behind. Again, we thank Representative Backer for bringing forward this street funding bill, and thank you, Chair Torkelson, and the Transportation Finance Committee for hearing this bill today. We respectfully ask that the committee adopt House File 1550 and to include funding for city streets in their comprehensive transportation bill. Thank you.
Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Tony Klotik, and I am... Not close enough? All right. I'll swing over. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Tony Klotik, and I am the city administrator for the city of Rushford, Minnesota. And we, too, would like to thank Mr. Backer, Representative Backer, for introducing this bill. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this today. Rushford is a city of 1,720 population in southeastern, in the southeastern part of Minnesota. And like the other 709 small cities under the population of 5,000 in the state, some of which the members represent, represented here today, Rushford does not receive state aid for small, for city streets. Responsibly, however, the city of Rushford increased its levy 9.75% for this budget year, with street maintenance among its highest priorities, and we envision several iterations of increased levy to cover maintenance and repair in the upcoming years, because it's a priority to us, and we already have identified $8 million worth of street projects for the city of Rushford that we have to address. That's a little over $4,000 per capita for the city of Rushford. Small cities could use a partner. Right now, we tackle road maintenance on our own to preserve our streets and make them last as long as possible. We recognize that you have a tremendous responsibility here to budget transportation funding for all residents of the state. And as you know, cities have responsibly managed and effectively managed their increasing budget pressures. I want to touch just quickly on three points, and then I'll wrap up my comments. There are all kinds of metrics with regards to pavement management that I'm sure this committee's seen, and we've seen them too, and I called up our engineer because, believe it or not, a city of 1,720 people does have engineering advice. We're not that far out in the boonies. We do get professional advice. And there are guidelines for trying to maintain streets for 50 years. We recognize that. And we recognize also that whether you're a small city or a big city or a county, we're not coming anywhere close to maintaining those metrics. Okay? We're not coming anywhere close to maintaining our streets based on those metrics, which means we're not getting the maximum useful life out of our roads. We recognize that. All right? That's a fact, whether you're a city, county, state, or the federal government. The other fact is small cities under 5,000 population do not get state aid for streets. They did back in 2015, and we want to thank you for that. That did help. But we do not get state aid for streets. And I guess if we were provided state aid for streets, I try to think of a metric that I could share with the committee that would have some value. And from my standpoint, it's this. The dollars that you would share or provide to small cities on a per capita basis or a per linear foot basis, you wouldn't get more representation. Small cities represented, you know, small city representation per linear foot. Our representatives get out and check every linear foot that we spend. Your dollar would be wisely spent in small cities. It would go where it needs to go. Having said that, and for those reasons, we ask the legislature to approve the reliable funding for city streets and to pass HF 1550. And on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, and on behalf of the City of Rushford, thank you again for this opportunity.
Thank you. I believe the townships would like to make some remarks. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. I'm Gary Peterson, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Townships. I'd like to thank Representative Backer for introducing this bill. I think it's a great idea. And I, sitting here listening to the testimony of the small cities, and I could have plugged the term townships into their testimony. And we have the same issues they have. I'd love to see an amendment and the bill cover townships as well, if we could get some dollars toward our transportation needs as well. Our infrastructure is badly needing beefing up as we look at the equipment and trucks coming our way this day and age. And again, I don't want to take up any more of your time, but I think it's a great bill, and we would fully support it and like to see townships included. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the two representatives for the cities have left, so it could be more of a rhetorical question, but what this bill does is take money out of the general fund to help pay for the roads, which is, you know, maybe a good thing to do, but the general fund is also where LGA comes from, and I see the chair of the property tax division sitting here, and he's in the committee with us, that we also have pressures to increase LGA. So I guess the question I would have in my mind is that we had to come down to a choice between taking money out of the general fund to fund more roads or providing more local government aid to these cities and townships. I guess the question is, where do we come down with that decision? And that's a decision we're going to have to make here. And they can answer that if they want, but in some ways it's a rhetorical question. These are the decisions we got to make. Do we give more local government aid? Do we take money out of that pot of money where that would come from and give it to them for roads? Which way would they prefer us go?
Thank you, Representative Becker. Quickly.
It's a fair question. As the mayor of a small community, and I know how important local government aid is because we do not have the tax capacity in greater Minnesota. I went through the time when we saw the cuts in local government aid during that time, and I was mayor, and we didn't raise our levies. We kept it down to 1% or 2%. So I understand how the local government aid, at the same time, understand how important. So you're asking a person from a smaller community, I would say both, because I know how local government aid is. Helps us. I know there's representatives who disagree with me, and that's fine. But when I was mayor, we used local government aid to lower property tax. So it's not going to be a decision totally up for me, but I represent 42 communities, 41 of them under 5,000. I represent 105 townships. So I represent a large area of and seven counties, a large part of greater Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A follow-up, Representative Nelson.
So, Mr. Chair, it's like we said earlier with the suburban transit providers were here. We are all here fighting over the scraps that we have at the state, and we have limited funds, and there are some that would like to limit them even more than we have. It's just a matter. These are decisions we're having to make, and at times different groups come here and they want one thing, but then they don't want to help us out with the other side about how we're going to pay for that. So, Mr. Chair, that's all there is. I guess.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Backer, there's some shifting in the motor vehicle lease sales tax in Section 7. Would you describe that for us?
Representative Backer.
Well, if you look at that, what we're doing, and I have a summary. Did you guys get this summary? Was there an update with this, Chair? Or no?
Do not see it.
Okay, I just have that there. Section 7 here.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. Basically, what we're doing, Chair and Representative Johnson, is we're taking $5 million, give or take, depending on what year, I'm just using it as a general, from the motor MVLST, motor vehicle lease sales tax, and we're utilizing it to fund the $50 million. This program is roughly $50 million. Roughly $25 million goes to small cities. $25 million goes to cities over $5,000. Now, there is a portion in this bill that if we get over $50 million, because we're being creative and we're using the general fund money from interest when we have a surplus. We realize when we don't have a surplus, we won't use that interest. But if there isn't anything over $50 million, then that extra would go to cities under $5,000. Did I answer your question, Representative?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my concern is the impact on greater Minnesota transit. Again, we're facing a zero-sum game in that maneuver. And if I'm reading this right, we'd be looking at, per fiscal year, at least $2,500, more than $2,500 that would be reduced to $2.5 million, rather, that would create a reduction to Greater Minnesota Transit. Do you have ideas on how that could be backfilled or what? How? Because that would obviously have an impact on transit throughout Greater Minnesota.
Yeah, Chair Representative Johnson there. No, I don't have an idea. It's a very fair question. I'm not married to this to be done this way. What I'm married to is we as a state requires our cities to do a lot of things. And there's mandates, and we as a state, I believe, needs to take that responsibility and help with streets. So when we put together this bill, we looked at different ways of doing it. We were creative with the interest rates. So am I married to it? No. Do I have an answer to your question where we would make that up? No, I do not have an answer, Representative.
Do you have another question, or Sam Johnson?
I just have a comment. That does have an impact on Greater Minnesota Transit. Those riders are impacted. I'm totally sympathetic with the challenge for the small cities. We got to be smarter than that, than taking it from other cities and find a better way to do that, and I hope you can do that.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair, members, to correct the spreadsheet in conferring with Mr. Burris, the reduction that you see on line 41 and 42 would actually not be included in this bill. That was an error in drafting the spreadsheet. It was pulling from the reduction that was passed out of this committee relating to the legacy allocation under the motor vehicle lease sales tax. So there was some language included in that, and an error that was included in this spreadsheet. But as the bill stands, if it were enacted, there would not be a reduction in Greater Minnesota Transit or the Suburban County CASA allocation from the motor vehicle lease sales tax. Essentially, what this bill would do was just take 4% of the total tax out of the general fund, $32 million a year, for this funding stream.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Small cities, did you want to testify? Carolyn?
Carolyn, did
you? No.
Oh, I thought you were.
No, I Mr. Lee answered the question.
Then Mr. Novak. And then I have a couple other questions. Members, we have one more bill to do that will take some time. And I have a 3 o'clock meeting, so if we don't get done, we'll come back. Mr. Novak.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Steve Novak from the Minnesota Intercounty Association. We do have concerns with the bill, as was referenced earlier, related to the lease vehicle sales tax, and also the feeling that this policy sort of moves in the opposite direction of House File 901, which passed this committee and has also passed the House Tax Committee, that deals directly with that issue in a way that we think is appropriate and also consistent with history going back to 2008. I don't have to remind this committee, but the one and only time in 30 years where we've actually passed a comprehensive transportation bill, that was part of the negotiation that actually allowed that package to pass, or we'd be zero for 30. So we really hope that that's respected in the end, and we understand Representative Backer has identified a real problem. We'd like to work with them to help solve that. We just don't think that this vehicle is the best way to do it, and hope that you stick with the policies that are inside House File 901, which currently resides and has passed the House Tax Committee.
President Kosnick.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson, and I share some of the concerns, or I have major concerns with this bill and the portions that it challenges and changes the established motor vehicle sales tax distribution. That 50% goes to the collar counties, and the history that goes behind that. The collar counties have been paying an additional sales tax for the last 9 years, and it hasn't worked out very well, but those constituents have been paying a lot of money, and this bill changes that formula. And the money that's derived from the motor vehicle sales tax is huge, of very significant importance to those counties, and as was mentioned, we already have established a position on that a little bit, and I in previous sessions, and I hope that that position will be reiterated. I've talked to Representative Backer about this bill. Aside from the lease tax, I'm also concerned with lines 2.21, the second sentence, then 2.22 and 2.23, that after funds are reached of $50 million, then any overage is going to only one part of the money and not the other, which is, again, I don't think it's fair and just, and I believe the author has previously agreed, I don't want to put words in his mouth, to strike that language.
Representative Kosnick, this bill is being laid over for possible inclusion, so adjustments can be made.
I think my point is made, and I appreciate the committee's time. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Backer, I do want to continue to work with you to, transportation is a very important topic to the state, and I continue to, I think we can work something out and to address your concerns without the sacrifice of some of the others, people that are relying on established funds.
Representative Hausman. Representative Hausman passes, and I believe then we can wrap this up. Representative Backer, any closing remarks?
Thank you, members, committees, and yes, I'm open to working with the chair and the other members to create a situation that will allow us to address our much-needed needs throughout the state, but especially, of course, our side city streets in all communities. Thank you.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1550 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, members.
Thank you. Finally, we have House File 1725, Representative Drazkowski. To your bill.
Are we moving this to, Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry. The motion is to pass this bill and refer to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I move House File 1725 be passed and be referred to Ways and Means Committee.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, House File 1725 addresses the issue of milk trucks that we talked about earlier in session, and it's a simple bill, a very easy read for a bill, as we looked at some that are more complicated than this one. But simply, it provides a 10% exemption in the weight limit for single-unit vehicles. Those are the straight trucks we talked about earlier, the ones that are prevalent in milk hauling, especially on our smaller farms throughout the Dairy Belt of Minnesota. This provides an exemption for them from the point of production to, in other words, from a farm to maybe another farm or to the point of first processing or the milk plant. And so that's really the contents of that part of the bill, and then it also provides for a study to have the Department of Transportation work together with the affected counties to identify the deficient bridges so that we can focus our limited resources in those areas properly on the bridges that will help us increase safety even more for this sector and for the people of Minnesota. That's the bill, Mr. Chair, and with us we have Mr. Shostrom from the Minnesota Milk Producers.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lucas Shostrom. I'm Executive Director of Minnesota Milk Producers Association, and we work to represent all dairy farmers across the state. Mr. Chair, members, Representative Drazkowski laid out this bill well, but what we're looking at here is allowing straight trucks a 10% overage, and it's important to note that they still must follow all local postings, and it also, as he said, studies bridge locations relative to routes. Now, the Department of Transportation has identified for us where the bridges are, but we have not at all analyzed which routes actually go over any of these deficient bridges, and so this bill would allow us to do that. Just three things I'd like you to know. This is patterned after 2010 law. That was essentially sunset in 2014, so we are following that precedent exactly, allowing a 10% overage. And current law actually encourages the 10% overage. If you're caught on the road at the legal limit, you're good to go. But if you make it to the milk plant, you actually can already be 10% over. So maybe you're encouraged even to race to the milk plant as fast as you can. And finally, milk trucks are unique compared to all other trucks. due to food safety rules, you can't have any baffles in milk trucks, and a baffle in a gasoline truck, for example, would stop the liquid from sloshing. In a milk truck, due to food safety rules, since we need to clean the entire inside of that tank, if you have a half-full tank or less, all that milk is going to be coming right up behind the driver at any stop, putting pressure on the brakes, putting pressure on the roads. And when I talked to a University of Minnesota truck instructor who also does research in this, he said milk trucks are unique and they deserve more study. Also, this results in fewer trips. Our cows are only going to make so much milk each day. And whether we do that in so many trips or so many more trips, that's going to change the carbon footprint of our milk. So this limits the wear on our roads in that regard and also lowers the carbon footprint of our milk. Finally, two more things. The pasteurized milk ordinance, anytime you back up a milk truck to a bulk milk tank on the farm, you need to empty every single drop out of that tank. And that is a federal law that you need to follow, again, for those same food safety rules that you can clean the entire tank. And I just want to reiterate, we're not talking about semi-trailers here. We're talking about straight trucks that are one unit, the smaller trucks that we need to get on our smaller farms across our state. So that's who this benefits the most. And with that, I'll take any questions, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shostrom. I appreciate your being here. I thought perhaps you would have brought some cheese samples today.
My wife, the cheesemaker, is in the audience, so I'll blame that on her. Yesterday was Women's Day, but I'll still throw some blame on her once in a while.
We don't allow passing the buck here. I believe we have some testifiers. Please come forward and present your information. Identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nancy Dobenberger with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on this bill this afternoon. MnDOT has serious concerns with this bill. Laws regarding allowable weight limits, lengths, and widths of commercial motor vehicles are designated to ensure safe vehicle operation on Minnesota's roadways and to preserve the state's investment in highways and bridges, which comprise about 80% of the state's investment in public infrastructure. House File 1725 would create a 10% weight increase for single-unit vehicles transporting fluid milk from the point of production to another point of production for additional loading or to the point of first processing. The bill seeks a 10% increase on every axle. By raising the axle weight 10%, they'll be doing 46% more damage to the pavements due to the exponential nature of load damage. Again, the current proposal seeks to allow 46% more damage to pavements. This measure would also increase damage to bridges used by these overweight vehicles. Although bridges in Minnesota have been analyzed for this additional 10% increase for the winter seasonal allowance and load posted accordingly, allowing additional 10% weight year-round will also cause bridges to deteriorate more rapidly due to these additional heavier loaded trips. Spreading out heavier loads on additional axles usually helps both bridges and pavements perform better under heavier weights. However, this bill is for single-unit trucks, which generally do not have the space to add axles. In regards to the proposed study, as it was mentioned, MnDOT already has identified load-posted bridges in the state, as well as put points or overlaid that map with the first processing facilities and provided that to the milk producers. So a statewide analysis that's mentioned in the bill language is not necessarily cost-effective, but it would be more efficient upon demand to analyze routes on a case-by-case basis as requested. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I'll take any questions you might have.
Thanks, Ms. Dobenberger. I don't have any questions right now, but I know you'll be available. I'm sorry. Representative Petersburg does have a question.
Just a quick question. Are you aware that there was a fiscal note prepared for the committee today?
Ms. Dobenberger.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, I am not aware of all that is in that fiscal note.
Well, what
Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, one of the things I'm wondering about is usually they come from the department agency that's directly impacted. Now, on the second page, it says for long-term fiscal considerations, and it says maybe very slight increases in pavement wear due to these increased loads. and even local impact, it says the same thing, and it sounds like your testimony is different. So I'm wondering, is that a discrepancy, or are we not really sure about what's going on here?
Ms. Baubenberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. To be able to calculate that more succinctly, what we would need to know are how many trucks or routes that we're talking about each day or per year.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, and I agree with that. However, your testimony talked about 46% more damage, and you raised all sorts of higher limits of awareness, worrisome kind of concerns, and so it doesn't sound like maybe it is that much, and so I'm just curious to know, you know, what is the actual impact, and it sounds to me like you don't really know. You're just making supposition on based upon some statistics and don't really know how much of wear and tear will actually be on the roads.
Ms. Baubenberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, as I mentioned earlier, we can calculate that. So what the 46% increase is referring to is on any given axle, if the load is increased by 10%, the amount of damage that's done per that trip would be an additional 46%, not 10%, but 46% per additional 10% of load per axle.
Thank you, the representative of the townships. Scott?
Mr. Chair, while he's coming down, could I?
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you. Just to that point, Mr. Chair, and members, our milk truck drivers are already traveling the roads with these trucks, and, you know, the discussion around this is, and, you know, if you go from one kind of truck to another, milk truck drivers are not going to be changing the trucks or their driving habits largely with this bill. Many of them are accruing fines, and what we want to do is to bring the law to match what's going on, and at the same time give us the ability to find out the areas that might be problematic in the future and fix those bridges. So that's what we want to do with the bill. I don't see that this is going to change behavior out there, although Ms. Daubenberger's comments may match what would happen theoretically if you go from one kind of truck to another. This bill isn't going to effectuate that.
Thank you, Representative. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gary Peterson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Townships, and thank you for allowing us to testify on behalf of this bill. We, of course, are concerned about the weight limits, and as they keep moving up, the exemptions continue to come our way, and as we allow more and more exemptions and higher weight limits, our roads are really taking a beating. And it's not only the bridges. It's the entire roads that take the beating, especially when this is 365 days of the year. We have weather events when it rains, our roads get soft, and we're taking on this extra beating. As far as the testimony with the milk truck itself and the sloshing of the milk, you have to remember that the truck only gets full once, and that truck is traveling from farm to farm without it being full most of the way. So I don't know that that's a big argument in this case either. But again, very concerned about the weight limits, and as Representative Torkelson said, right now many of them are exceeding their limits, and if we give them 10% more, are they going to exceed it by that much more, and where will this stop? Thank you.
Just one correction. That was Representative Draskowski that said
sorry.
That, not Representative Torkelson.
Yes.
Be careful, Mr. Peters. I believe we're going to hear from the counties.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, Emily Pugh with the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'll be brief. You've heard this message before, of course, but on behalf of AMC and county engineers, we do have concerns with this bill. For our local roads, it doesn't necessarily always matter what the product is, but allowing heavier trucks to impose additional economic costs to our counties is something we are very concerned about because it causes further damage to already deteriorating highway infrastructure and additional strain to our aging and deficient bridges. And this is something, this is the cost would be associated to all levels of government and including taxpayers. So in a time when we're talking about more transportation funding needs, we just want to address the already the damage that this would incur to our roads. So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I do not see any questions from members. Representative Vazkowski, I think we should check with Mr. Lee about the fiscal impact of this bill because I may have made the wrong motion. Mr. Lee, is there a fiscal impact of this bill?
Mr. Chair and members, according to the fiscal note prepared by MnDOT today, there is no fiscal impact.
In light of that, I'm going to change the motion on this bill, Representative Vazkowski. I'm going to move that this bill be referred to the General Register. Would you care to make any final comments?
I think it was my motion, Mr. Chair.
That's true, Mr. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you.
I'm just advising you to change your motion.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not really any more comments. Thank you for the time hearing this bill. And, Mr. Chair, I would amend my motion so that instead of going to the General Register, that House File 1725 be referred to the General Register.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
You're on to the General Register, Representative Drazkowski. This meeting is adjourned.